DevOps has been the subject of many episodes of Software Engineering Daily. And yet, the question we continue to ask ourselves is, what is DevOps? In order to understand the present, we must look into the past. On today's show, we break down the history of DevOps with Demir Selmanovic, the lead technical editor at TopTal. From waterfall software development to the Agile Manifesto, from lean manufacturing to the productive pinnacle of DevOps Nirvana, Demir also wrote a blog post called What the Hell is DevOps?, which he posted on the TopTal blog. Full disclosure, TopTal is a sponsor of our show, but this episode doesn't really discuss TopTal, so hopefully that doesn't impact the trust of our listeners. This is not like a sponsored content type of episode. Speaking of which, if you are a fan of Software Engineering Daily, we want to know how to improve. Please take 5 minutes to fill out our listener survey. There is a link to the survey in our newsletter and on our website. We would love to know what you think, so please fill it out. We want to hear know what you want to hear more of, what you want to hear less of. We read all of the feedback that we get, so please fill out the survey. Help us build the best software podcast. Demir Selmanovic is the lead technical editor at TopTal. Demir, welcome to Software Engineering Daily.
Thanks. Good to be here.
The focus of our conversation today is going to be DevOps. And in order to understand DevOps, you've said that we need to travel back in time to the earlier days of software development. And you write that programming used to take place in labs, and the programmers used to be scientists. Could you describe the time period and setting in which people first started developing software?
Yeah, sure. If you take a look at software and hardware, they're practically two sides of the same coin. And early computers and computer systems had really limited capacity in regards to their functionalities, but as well to availability to people. And they had very limited group of users. So the problems and software that they were solving was, well, again, the same word, limited in their scope and functionalities. So, and really programmers were actually programming computers to perform certain tasks. And that's exactly what software development is and was, especially at the time. So
since then, it's moved towards this more user-centric model.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, early programmers, if you just remember how old computers looked like, they were really big systems taking a couple of rooms, etc. And programmers really had to fully understand the hardware that was running their system just to be able to practically talk to it and give it instructions. And different systems had different ways of interacting and presenting their data. So the
early days of programming was probably more about just getting the thing to work properly rather than thinking about the user demands and the finer points of the software that was being developed. So when did we get to the point to where there were enough users of the software where, the interaction between programmers and users was more of like a customer relationship where there were higher demands on developers?
Yeah, well, the point is simple. When computers really became personal computers and when they became affordable to, let's say, mere mortals. So that's when new types of problems that could be solved by computers showed up, new ideas came in, and a lot more demand for software development showed up in general.
Okay, so these increased demands on developers, they led to what you call a subdivision into different types of developers. When did this subdivision of developer types occur, and what are some examples of these programmer subtypes that evolved early on?
Well, first of all, subdivision or subtype, I'm not sure that that's the right correct way to name things, but first of all, there are good and bad programmers. And good programmers can do whatever they want, while bad programmers, they do things that they just can and are capable of. But really, there are so many ways that programmers are kind of split in groups, depending on what type of classification you're looking at. I mean, you have front-end developers, you have back-end developers, and then there is a term called a full-stack developer, but we could even actually start a discussion whether these full-stack developers really exist. But also, if you take a look at, full-stack developer, if you early or maybe, I don't know, some years ago, you could name someone a full-stack developer, but now just take a look at any layer of software development databases. They're so much granulated and there are so different ways to do things that you can't really say someone is really handling things, is a full-stack because he knows just one or two types of databases. There are just even in NoSQL world, there are a lot of things. On the other hand, you have iOS developers, Android developers, web developers, Java developers, JavaScript, C#, Ruby, even now the platform, even the frameworks, like you have Ruby on Rails developers that, they really don't, there are Ruby on Rails developers that don't really understand the Ruby as a language behind it. So there are a whole bunch of different ways to classify them that, that's why I just say there are good and bad programmers and good ones.
Okay, so as we've moved to this world of having more consumer products and faster software development cycles, it's led to a separation of concerns into different types of programmers specializing in different things. What are the costs and the benefits of this separation of concerns? Because it seems like the separation of concerns into different programmers. You've got iOS over here, you got your Android over here. Isn't this a clean partitioning? Doesn't it create harmony?
It should. In ideal world, there's a book called Utopia. Maybe people should read it. But whenever you create more communication lines, and by separating concerns, you definitely do that between developers. You're adding more complexity to the whole IT value chain and IT value stream, actually. So it adds more work in tracking and aligning assignments. It adds controlling roles in the team. So it adds additional complexity to the overall team as well. I mean, this is the cost, but it's necessary cost and we have to pay it. But every cost comes with a tax. So that's the point.
Okay. So essentially what you're saying is, so a while ago, programmers started being broken up into different population subtypes. And ever since then, so I don't know, since the consumer computer revolution, whatever it was, the 70s or the 80s, we've had these programmer subtypes and we've been grappling with this problem as a community. And it's still a really difficult challenge because of all the different types of programming that goes on. So one of the early solutions to this different programmer segmentation of responsibilities was a process that is known as waterfall. And in software engineering communities, people often dread the term waterfall. So what is waterfall and how did it develop?
Waterfall is, in its essence, as an idea, it's a good thing. It uses this fact that we have separation of concerns, and there is no much talking about whose fault it is when it comes to a problem, and there are always problems, because there are clear communication lines, one-directional communication lines, actually always down. That's why we call it waterfall, between different groups involved in the system. So you have analysis, you have development, you have testing, you have deployment, you have support. And when things go from one to another, it never goes back. It's never supposed to go back, actually. So in idea, as its idea, the waterfall is great. But waterfall is, I don't know, I always compare it to a real waterfall. Just try standing at the bottom of even the smaller one, and feel just a single drop falling on your head, it's going to hurt a lot. So waterfall really hurts when you're not standing where you should be. I mean, if you're just two steps away, it's very nice to see. Things go down nicely and then the river continues to flow. But if you're kind of caught in that waterfall, it's never a pleasant thing.
Is this a sign that people were implementing waterfall incorrectly, or was it fundamentally broken?
No, I can't say the waterfall is fundamentally broken because it really solved a problem at the time when it showed up. People started coming up with more effective development cycles, and they started developing. So that's perfectly fine. What happened is we're
so
humans.
They started organizing. They started saying, they started saying, like, software. This, first, we'll have software engineers do this part. Then we'll have QA do this part. Then we'll have the sysadmins do this part. And then we'll have QA do another round. And you start to have a planning process aligned among these different segments of programmers.
Yeah, and that was perfectly fine for a short period in time. I mean, even now. There are things that you really have to do in a waterfall method. I mean, okay, take a look at a thing like Rosetta Mission. I really love that thing because, really, they landed a probe 10 years after on a comet that was moving very fast. And they actually had to plan it 10 years in advance. That had to be waterfall. The problems that came in is when actually they needed to be a little bit agile because the probe didn't land as they expected. And that's when all the problems started. They lost power and Philly eventually went to safe mode and shut down. So the waterfall is good. It solves certain set of problems. But especially in modern software development, there is absolutely no way that things can be planned that much in advance. I mean, you can't even plan things more than a couple of weeks in advance before someone will come up with a new idea.
Okay, so as we start to move towards, a more modern software development process, let's talk about the historical points in between. So in 2001, the Agile Manifesto was created. How did Agile change the perspective around software development?
A lot. So Waterfall was focusing on process and kind of using this separation of concerns, practically building walls between different layers. Agile came in with more humane touch to the whole process. And it's actually one of the points in Agile Manifesto is it insists on face-to-face communication. So it not just that it brought together all types of developers, all people involved in the software development. It also brought in clients and made them all communicate much more on a frequent basis. I mean, take a look at Scrum. It doesn't really insist, but you really should be having those daily stand-ups and constant reviews of the whole team, talking together, sharing information, sharing problems, helping each other, etc. So instead of really just making them work and never talk to each other unless they are handing over things, it really insists on building a team and having this human communication, even with the clients, which is really great thing because you have a product owners that are usually representing actually clients' interests there.
And Agile, as you said, emphasizes the connection between these different stakeholders in a human way. So rather than a procedural, highly mechanized manner like in Waterfall, so what are the downsides of this type of human development?
That's when you put people together that... assuming they are interacting correctly and they're all normal, they become friends, and it's very difficult to say no to a friend. And that's so instead of kind of keeping your focus on actually delivering a working software, meeting your milestones, etc. Quite often, you have to be more agile and lose focus than you should actually. So that's, again, it goes to this soft skills kind of a feature that Agile brought into software development. And actually, that's Lean is perfect way to solve that, because Lean principles are just added on top of, and they work together with Agile, just keeping the mentality and the focus on what you want to do and what you need to do actually.
Okay, so this gets us to Lean. Lean is not necessarily like an evolution that is disjoint from Agile. It's more like it's a complementary thing to Agile. So describe how Lean relates to Agile and how the two principles work together.
Well, if you take a look at Agile, it focuses on how you want to do things and delivering things. And Lean principles are supporting more mentality and the focus of doing the right things at the time. And that's Agile allows you to be flexible during the whole process, accepting change as a normal thing of your development, while still keeping things under control by applying Lean principles.
Okay. And after Agile and Lean principles have been developed and adopted by organizations, and if people are still kind of confused on Agile and Lean, there's plenty of other podcasts that talk about this story. But so we're eventually able to enter into the age of DevOps. So how do software teams move beyond the days of Agile and Lean and into the world of DevOps?
Well, I don't think they move from Agile and Lean, actually, because DevOps is not upgrade of Agile and Lean principles. It's just a matter of applying these principles to the whole IT value stream. So all these methodologies before, so take a look at, we just mentioned Waterfall, Agile, and Lean. They were all focusing strictly on software development cycle up to the point when it's handed over to operations, so to deployment, support, etc. DevOps is just a natural next step in including operations as part of the whole IT value stream and applying these principles. So DevOps, I mean, I don't even like the fact that we write DevOps with capital O, because it still keeps kind of a separation. DevOps should be really, in my view, just a single word that shows that the development and operations teams are one team, actually, that is developing, that is delivering value to end user. And that's about it.
Okay, so just to emphasize that definition, because we've been, you know, we did an entire week of shows about DevOps, and we have been searching for a concise definition on Software Engineering Daily. So to reiterate, what is DevOps?
DevOps, well, the best definition I could find, and I really urge everyone to read the Gene Kim's The Phoenix Project. It's a very simple book, but according to Gene Kim, DevOps is just a result of implementing Lean principles to the whole IT value stream. And that's the simplest thing. I mean, it's a mindset. It's not a set of tools. It's not anything that you can qualify and list like this is something that one single engineer should be doing to be a DevOps. DevOps is a mentality of the whole organization.
Okay. So some listeners may be wondering how that they can make their organization more like a DevOps type of culture. They've heard these things about DevOps and how fantastic it is. You refer to DevOps as a three-lane highway of implementation, and I'd like to go through each of these so that a listener who's curious about how to get a more DevOps-like organization can implement it. So at a high level, what do you mean by this three-lane highway implementation?
Oh, okay. Well, again, I really have to say that I rephrase this. The three-lane highway is something that I did come up with as a reference, but it's a reference to the three ways of DevOps explained in the Phoenix Project book that were defined by a character there called Eric. He's referring to DevOps as implementing some three ways in an organization. I've kind of changed them a little bit and adopted them to my understanding of how everything should look like. So it's just three layers of an organization, three layers of accepting culture, I would say, like that, within the software development organization.
Okay, so are you saying these are these three different ways, or are these three like tiers where you gradually go from one of these from this weakest implementation to the strongest implementation?
Yeah, that's why I use the highway reference, because you usually start in a slow lane, then you speed up, move a little bit to center, and then when you really know where you're going and no need to stop, you're just rushing on the fast lane. And that's about that's exactly why I chose highway reference to it.
Okay, and the first lane of the highway is about understanding the importance of the whole system. So you say, like, developers are not responsible for the entire business. Why do they need to understand the importance of the whole system? And how does this, like, if I'm a developer, I'm working at a broken organization, how does it help for people to start to understand the importance of the entire organization?
Okay, well, first thing, I'm saying that developers should always stream to understand the whole system. And there is no way that a single developer in a large organization with multiple teams and different projects will understand everything of every project. But they should always be looking for ways to gain more knowledge. I mean, development is creative work. And the more a developer knows about the system, they will definitely have more options to make it better. And it also makes a communication between different team members or different teams much smoother. It removes dependencies, and resolving potential conflicts is much easier. So the more people know about the system, can definitely improve the system itself. Because instead of improving individual points of the system, you're just seeing the system as a whole. I mean, yeah, I'm referring this to kind of a teachings of William Edwards Deming. Listeners can Google for a guy, but I'm actually quoting him in my in the text that you were referring to about importance of profound understanding of the system.
Okay, and this profound understanding of the system, this helps us get to another point that you stress the importance of, which is the idea that, you know, even at the earliest stages of this DevOps three-lane highway, it's really important to get people thinking about assuring that everybody else's workflow is uninterrupted. So this sounds really simple, like I'm working on my stuff, you're working on yours, you know, we're not going to interrupt each other. But many times in a software organization, we have a complex chain of dependencies where, you know, I need to finish something before you can start it. So how do we ensure uninterrupted workflow in an environment that has all these dependencies?
Well, I don't think there is really a simple solution that applies to everyone. But one of the things is actually identifying and, seek and destroy practically. You need to be in constant seek mode, identifying bottlenecks and finding things that you can improve in your organization all the time. And making sure that your work is actually not stalling is not enough. You always need to find a way to increase the flow, because once you resolve one bottleneck, you've increased the flow of your system, but it doesn't mean that there isn't another one. Maybe it has a higher throughput than the one that you resolve, but it's still a bottleneck. And when you're constantly increasing the flow, you're actually speeding up production and increasing your organization. So there are numerous methodologies to increase the flow about limiting work in progress. You have theory and constraints, Six Sigma. So all of these are at disposal. These are really good theories that are implemented in various ways in different organizations. So really, this depends on a specific case, but the same principle is always the same. Keep the system flow uninterrupted, find and destroy bottlenecks.
And as we move beyond the first lane of DevOps, the simple DevOps principles, into the second lane, you emphasize building a feedback loop of communication between the different silos of an organization. So a silo is often associated with an organization that has trouble communicating information effectively around the organization. So what does a feedback loop at a productive DevOps organization look like?
Yeah, well, if we didn't have upstream communication, we would actually end up in waterfall, because waterfall had just one directional communication, just down. Hand over things, explain everything that you think you should, and that's it. That's perfect if every single silo was delivering software without any, not software, but their work items, let's say, without any problems, without bugs, etc. Then we would never need to change waterfall. It would be perfect. But since we are working in very, we know the word agile environment, it's very important that each small work item that is sent downstream, in this case, we're talking about DevOps, so from development to operations, is followed by an instant upstream configuration that it is okay, didn't cause any additional bottlenecks, that it has appropriate and expected quality, etc. So this type of communication assures actually that you are still on adhering to all the rules in the first from the first lane, which means keeping the flow uninterrupted. Because if you send something and you don't know if it was good or bad, and you actually sent some defective piece of work downstream, you've caused another bottleneck. So resolving them is actually a consequence of having the proper upstream communication as well.
The third lane of DevOps is what you call Warp 10. This is the fastest lane of DevOps. What are the features that an organization has when it gets to the fast lane of DevOps?
Okay. Well, let me just summarize what an organization gets when they are, let's say, stabilized on lane two. You have an organization that is constantly resolving bottlenecks and speeding up. All communication and all defects are communicated back up, removed, and sent back down if they occur. That means that you have quality assurance, that you have deliveries that are in time, and that the quality of your work is flawless. So that means if you don't have too much demands, you're perfectly fine. You're doing everything great, and you're actually constantly increasing your delivery speed. There is a great sentence in a book called Only the Paranoid Will Survive, actually. That's the title. If you want to move even faster, then you need to start taking some risks. And that's where this third lane is actually comes in, which is, okay, we have everything working perfectly. Let's try to come up with something new, something different that will help us. And that's in order to have some innovation, you have to give people time to do that. And you have to accept risks that that they will break things. The thing is that you need to implement learning, a mechanism from those breaks. You need to have a knowledge base, and you need to make sure that things are working. So take a look at any type of software. If you are prepared for any type of kind of a breaking incident, then resolving it is kind of a everyday business instead of firefighting. And that's firefighting is what you avoid when you have all these mechanisms from lane three implemented.
So only the paranoid survive. I thought this is a very interesting allusion. I think this is the book by Andy Grove, yeah. And in it, probably the risk that you're talking about that he takes is when Intel moves from being a memory business to a chip business. Is that correct?
Yeah, one of. But the bottom line is, that's exactly the reference I'm mentioning.
So can you explain more about how, I mean, maybe that's too much of a tangent for this conversation, but I'm really curious because I've never heard that that example associated with like, oh, if you have a highly functioning, fast moving, what we would now call DevOps organization, you can take a risk such as abandoning your pre-existing business model in a multi-billion dollar company and switch to something completely different.
Well, I'm not sure that the word is you could. I think that you should. And that's the point. I mean, take a look at, we have a whole bunch of examples in our industry. Take a look at Nokia. They're amazing example of how to things. So to save you some editing, they were awesome. They had great product. They were practically ruling the world. And at the point when someone came in with something innovative, with just one product, they started going down, and they never recovered from it. So if you want to stay on top, you definitely need to be ready to take chances and constantly innovate within what you are currently doing.
I've heard of organizations that try to switch to DevOps, or they claim that they're making a switch to DevOps, but they actually just end up rebranding their current process, and they end up with, you know, going from one form of waterfall to a different form of waterfall. What happens in these types of organizations?
Well, I would say they lack brains and courage to do and courage to accept the change. But okay, you asked me earlier, what is DevOps? I think I should also say that what DevOps is not. And DevOps is not a set of tools. It's not of system automation, software, or anything like that. And currently, you have a whole bunch of ads online or on job portals that people are looking for DevOps engineers. And there are my colleagues also defining them as DevOps engineers. Again, when we started this talk, you said that we're still looking for a definition of DevOps. And even the people that came up with it at the conference, how DevOps term was coined, actually, they're giving different definitions than what people are looking. Because when you open any DevOps job position online, you see they're listing certain tools, certain practices, or whatever. So they are looking for something that for an engineer. For something that's not defined, and still they're perfectly able to set the salary or everything else. So that's definitely conflicting with everything that DevOps actually presents. So maybe it's a bit harsh, but yeah, organizations that claim to adopt DevOps by doing these and hiring people and adding some automation or whatever and failing is really they lack vision and understanding.
Okay, I see your point. Do you really think it's that much of a red flag though? Like when a company has a job listing for a DevOps engineer, it is somewhat descriptive. It can be somewhat descriptive about what the position is. Because if they said, you know, one of these things like full stack engineer or backend engineer or sysadmin, all of those say they have a different connotation than the DevOps, than the connotation of the DevOps engineer, even though the DevOps engineer is not exactly descriptive of what DevOps is. It is descriptive of what the specific position entails.
Well, I disagree. I mean, one of the myths that's mentioned by Gene Kim, one of the leads actually in DevOps, at least in my view, is that there is a myth called DevOps is just infrastructure as code. True. We do require some automation to support frequent code deployments, and we're actually moving some assignments from operations to developers because they need to do things, but we're at the same time enabling operation teams as well with these things. But bottom line is a bug that has absolutely nothing with deployment, which is just a let's say, wrong calculation in CRM software, can break the system, just like a wrong firewall configuration that is done on virtual network setup on Amazon Web Services. At the end, the end user didn't get what they expect. They're unable to use it. So the system is broken. And the whole value stream from the beginning to end sucks. It doesn't work. So yeah, even though if you can have a whole bunch of Docker engineers that are creating a whole bunch of those things, or you can have Jenkins lighting all the green flags that all code is nicely compiled, etc. But at the end, it doesn't work. And that's the purpose. Purpose of the software at the end is to give value to their end users. If they're unable to use it, they don't really care where the problem is. And we're all part of the same team. So once we understand that developers, operations, even I would expect in the future, sometimes even sales, we're all part of the same value stream that starts at one point and ends when the user has operational system.
Okay, so let's talk about a good case or a best case scenario where an organization has a DevOps culture and it's focused on the value stream, a holistic, fast-moving perspective. How does this type of organization integrate newer types of software engineers like data scientists or data engineers or machine learning programmers or data analysts, or perhaps even, you know, this comes to the sales discussion or the data-driven marketer discussion. How do we integrate these different types of engineers?
There should be no difference, actually, from integrating any other type of engineer. I mean, we're a team of equals, and as long as every team member is aware that we need to deliver value, that we need to remove all dependencies and bottlenecks and communicate to each other, working together and sharing information through proper communication channels, that all the control mechanisms are in place. And I mean, we could even bring a dentist as far as part of a team if we know what he needs to do.
Sure. Okay. That makes sense. So let's talk some about where you work, which is TopTal. And this is interesting to me because I think like TopTal is an organization. It's a big technical organization, but it's also a place where developers can find remote and decentralized work. And so this is, you know, obviously you have some perspective on both what TopTal wants out of DevOps as an organization and what other companies that come to TopTal looking for engineers want out of DevOps. So I guess I'll start by like asking how does DevOps work at TopTal?
Well, it works great. I mean, I'm not really part of our core development team that is responsible for our platform, and that's practically the only software development done by our internal staff. Toptal is a big company, 100% distributed throughout the world, and everyone is communicating nicely, actually. So I know that I'm part of DevOps in regards to developing Toptal platform. And considering the way I'm working with our teams and how things are picked up, handled, and communicated back to me, just today, actually, I had the change request for the platform that was executed flawlessly. So I'd say that it works great. I'm not the one managing the team, so I can't tell you if there are any internal organizational issues, but I guess that looking at the maturity of our platform, I'm perfectly happy with it.
Okay, so developers who come onto the Toptal platform to try to find work, and there are, I'm sure there are enterprises, well, I guess I should just ask, like, are there enterprises that are advertising jobs that say, we're looking for DevOps engineers, and are there people who are coming onto the Toptal platform and advertising themselves as DevOps engineers?
Yes and yes. But the good thing is that Toptal has a great team of matchers. So nothing on the Toptal platform is kind of magically automated. We have a really competent team of people that will talk to client, that will understand what they need, and then will find right people from the network to work with them. So even if someone comes in with, well, in my view, wrong definition, if they really need someone to automate their deployment, they will call it DevOps. So they will find someone who is perfectly capable to automate all deployments, tests, etc. On their platform. On the other hand, if someone comes in and advertises themselves as a DevOps engineer, they're perfectly welcome to pass all the screening that is, again, done by a great team of engineers from Toptal to confirm that they have appropriate knowledge to do what they say they do. So it's not a matter of terminology. It's a matter of giving our clients the correct people to solve their problems.
And many of the jobs that people find on Toptal are remote jobs. They're decentralized workforces. Are there any elements of DevOps? Like, I think of DevOps, it's like really based in communication. So what are the things that are hard to do in DevOps that might be at odds with the remote nature of jobs on Toptal?
I doubt there are any, actually. I mean, even this, we're really supportive of remote work as a way of living. And simply because it's a natural thing. Even if you're working in a building and communicating to your colleagues via email that are just two floors up, you're practically comparing to them, you're remote. It doesn't care. It doesn't matter, are you in the same building, same city, same time zone or not. So then again, if you take a look at these DevOps tools that I just mentioned earlier, these are all cloud solutions. And they don't have premises anyway. So I'd say that DevOps principles and mindset, considering, let's say, these potential DevOps tools, they're perfectly compatible with any type of remote work in software development.
Speaking of technologies, DevOps is not defined by the tech stack that a company uses, but there are these types of technologies that we hear about associated with DevOps a lot. You mentioned Docker, obviously, you know, anything to do with microservices, maybe Slack is a technology. What are the technologies that tend to be correlated with a DevOps organization?
Well, maybe I Chef, Consul, Jenkins, I think I mentioned it earlier when I was comparing something. Sonar Cube, Amazon Web Services, now you have Microsoft Azure. Those are all things that give you certain levels of automating your deployments and tests. So any platform that does that is well, accidentally or not, related to DevOps organizations.
Okay. But I suppose this is to focus on the technologies is to miss the point.
Exactly. Totally. I mean, once you have all the processes, and I've deliberately actually used an example of Rosetta Mission and Philly, because that's more than a software project. You can apply DevOps. DevOps is at the first place something that came to through software development world, let's say like that. But it's more a way of thinking that just like we took over Lean from manufacturing systems, DevOps is practically doing the same in software development. So maybe this time we can start with something in software development, and someone else will pick it up as paradigm rather than set of tools or processes. I mean, even when Lean and Agile principles were taken, there were no tools. There were just rules, mindset, and understanding on what it does.
So we've evolved from waterfall to agile and lean to DevOps. And I'm not sure what precipitated these exactly, other than like certain pain points. But I don't know. What do you think will be the next incarnation of a productive software organization? Is there some streak of pain points that exist even today with DevOps, where perhaps like eventually we're going to need some sort of revolution, and there will be yet another incarnation of this software organization productivity?
Well, first of all, I think we are currently very far from adopting DevOps as a standard in software development companies and organizations in general. So not just companies, but let's say teams. So even its definition is something that people still debate. And while at the same time, you have many companies that are still unable even to apply the basic agile principles and start really, let's say, adopting Scrum or even Kanban. Not to mention Lean or DevOps throughout the whole organization, etc. But each of these steps assumed growth of the team. So initially we started with one guy knowing everything. Then there were separations. Then we came up separations that caused actually growing and making teams. Then we have again, sorry. A DevOps expanding team even more from software development, including operations, and making them closer. Maybe in the future, this wall will be completely gone, and we all will be either programming somehow or configuring something somehow differently. I mean, it depends on how the development platforms will also evolve. But next step, if I take a look at this trend, we'll assume bringing in even more, let's say, groups or types of teams as part of the whole process. I mean, I mentioned earlier, I really think that salespeople that are first contact practically with the clients, especially when selling products, will very soon become part of the whole process. But even now, if we take a look at operations, there are still some guys that are handling infrastructure on a much lower level than just operations related to software development. So we could go both ways. We could expand more toward client-facing sides, but as well internally bring in more people that are still kind of outside of the whole system.
So to close off, you know, we've been talking about DevOps mostly in the context of modern software engineering, but TopTal is kind of, in some ways, I think it's kind of a little futuristic because it's, you know, it just has a different platform for how people find work and how teams are organized. And it kind of questions a lot of the things that we've taken for granted about how software development has to work, how organizations have to be structured. So speaking more broadly, not just about DevOps and how the software organizations work, but how companies work as a whole and how business works as a whole, what is your perspective on how the nature of work is going to evolve into the future?
Nature in work related to software development?
Just in the nature of doing business, whether you're a software engineer or any other kind of worker, because, I mean, as I understand, like from my conversation with Brendan about TopTal, like, you know, you guys have a pretty broad view of the types of employees who can change their workflow, you know, based on doing a more decentralized remote style of work.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I would expect that, and I think that I've even read that trends of remote and freelancing work are growing rapidly in the past few years. We're lucky to be there from the very beginning, but I can't imagine why I wouldn't write any type of let's say professional that doesn't really require hands-on work be in some office. We're even talking about those futuristic reviews of surgeons doing surgeries remotely, or even now you have telemedicine, where people are just really trying to help their patients just by talking to them on phone or Skype or exchanging some information online, etc. So any type of work that really doesn't require you to have a physical presence will easily be transferred to remote work. On top of that, you definitely get freelancing, which gives you freedom to work remotely from wherever you like, on jobs that you like. Software developers aren't the first ones doing that. I mean, if you take a look at writers and book authors and journalists, etc., they all had this type of engagement years ago. So we're just lucky that technology has caught up with us, and we can do our work remotely a lot easier and talk to you, for example, like now.
Cool. Well, Damir, thanks for coming on to Software Engineering Daily. This has been a great conversation about DevOps and a little bit about TopTal. So thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I hope we'll teach people more about DevOps.